And now for reading and writing and radio.
Sylvie helped Jane into her costume. It was a white cheesecloth dress with wreaths of large red roses around its neck and waist. While she was dressing, Letitia arrived with her hair still in curlers. Letitia put on her white cheesecloth dress. Then she sat down before the mirror, and Jane watched her unwind the curlers with expert fingers. The curls came out in long yellow pipes. Jane wondered if Letitia felt jumpy inside the way she did when she thought about To a Wild Rose. As if in answer to her thoughts, Letitia announced calmly, "I may be sick." "Now?" asked Jane, aghast. "Might, any time. Even when we're doing the grand parade?" "Might." "Even when we're doing To a Wild Rose?" "Might." Jane swallowed hard and wound one of her straggling locks around her fingers in pensive silence. Letitia added nothing to this thunderbolt, merely sniffing now and again, touching her nose delicately with her scented pocket handkerchief. Jane swiftly glanced at her in a sudden panic lest she should have to do To a Wild Rose all by herself. But Letitia, though pale, looked calm and resigned.
The author of that bit about stage fright was Eleanor Estes in The Moffats. But it could be you. WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University.
Last year, around this time, I had a writing class of teachers that met in my kitchen, and we had a lot of fun. And as it turned out, one of the teachers wrote a story about her son, who was in first grade and was in the Christmas program, and all the problems and difficulties and funny things that were happening. Another one of the teachers was directing the Christmas program in her school, and she proceeded to tell us all the things that were going wrong with her Christmas play. And then somebody said, "What were you in the Christmas play?" thinking back to when we were little kids. And it turned out that practically all of us had been in a Christmas play at some time or another, and that something had always gone wrong. If we hadn't been an angel balanced on a cloud and dropped our halo on the floor, or the cloud itself came down, why, then we'd been Donder or Blitzen and had our antlers fall down around our chins, or something like that. And we went on from the Christmas play, where many of us muffed our lines, or some of us did very gloriously, actually, to all sorts of different plays and things that we had been in. We have all been in the limelight at some time or other. Now, that's a term meaning in the spotlight, having people's eyes on you. And it comes from the old-fashioned stage where they used to have a light that was not of lime juice or the lime fruit, but of calcium oxide, which is called lime. And it was heated to a great brilliance, or so that you would light up the stage as with a spotlight. And so when you're in the limelight, it's as if you're in the spotlight. So even if you haven't been in a Christmas play, you've undoubtedly at some time been in the limelight. And that light doesn't necessarily have to be cast by a spotlight, but it could be by 10 or 50 or 100 pairs of eyes. I remember a lot of different times when I was in the limelight, and times that some of them were good and some of them were bad. The church that I went to as a kid had what they called Children's Day in the spring, and every kid in the Sunday school got to speak a piece or sing or do something like that, and there was great excitement. We did it up in front of the whole church. My main remembrance of Children's Day is the time that I was forgotten. I had prepared to sing, and the song was a little Christopher Robin song, and it went, a little boy kneels at the foot of the bed, bowed on his little hands, little gold head. Hush, hush, whisper who dares, Christopher Robin is saying his prayers. And I'd practiced it with my mother, and she'd accompanied me on the piano. It goes on quite a bit. And it came time for me to be on the program and to sing my bit, and somehow or other the person in charge forgot to call me up or missed my name. And the program went on all the way to the end, and I never was called. And I felt just terrible about it, because here I'd practiced hard, and not only that, you know how it is just before you perform. You get all queasy inside, and you get your nerves all steeled up to go on and to do it, and you're both looking forward to it, and you're not looking forward to it. And then here was all that getting ready wasted. So probably the reason I just sang it to you is because I still have a deep, deep need to sing that song that I never got to sing on the Children's Day program. I think my mother, I asked her about why I didn't get to sing it, and she said that she couldn't recall it, but that it was probably that at the end it was too late to say, oh, Jackie's been forgotten, that the service would have gone on. But the whole family remembers very well the time my brother, who was, he must have been 4 years old, spoke up his piece. And he got up in front, and he spoke it, and was so excited and delighted at being the center of all eyes, at being in the limelight, that when he came down off the stage, he told the woman in charge that he had another piece to speak. Well, he didn't. But she sent him back up on stage because she thought he had another piece to speak, and so he smiled broadly at the whole congregation, and my folks were wondering, what on earth is Craig doing up there again? And he announced, it's all about a plowel. Craig lisped, and so that was his way of saying flower. And then he began to sing. He extemporized. That means he made it up as he went along, and the family's never forgotten the song. He sang up in front, plowel, plowel, how do you like the wane? It's giving you a dwink. Plowel, 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 plow. And then everybody, you know, smiled and so forth, and he came off the stage and felt very good about having performed twice when he was only supposed to perform once. Well, children's books have many a passage about being in the limelight. Because it's such a good topic, I think, and it's one that we've all experienced, we know the agony and the ecstasy. You're probably familiar with Caddy Woodlawn, in the chapter Warren Performs. The last day of school was to be a speaking day with songs by the school and recitations by some of the pupils. Caddy and Warren both had pieces. Caddy's was a very noble one, beginning, a traveler on a dusty road strewed acorns on the lea, and one took root and sprouted up and grew into a tree. The poem went on to say that, as carelessly tossed acorns may grow into great oaks, so may little words and deeds of kindness grow into great and beautiful things. Under Mother's coaching, Caddy had practiced it with gestures and a fine Boston accent, and it was quite perfect. But everyone felt a little doubtful of Warren. His piece was so short that it seemed impossible that he should be able to forget it or mix it up in any way, but Warren was not gifted as a public speaker. He said it over and over as he went about the house. If at first you don't succeed, try, try again. That's easy, isn't it? You don't think I'll forget it, do you? Of course not, Warren, said Caddy. Just don't get stage fright, that's all. What's stage fright? Asked Warren with a worried tone. Oh, just being scared when you have to get up and see so many eyes looking at you. You won't have time to get scared with a piece as short as that, laughed Tom. Then he struck a dramatic attitude and declaimed, if at first you don't fricassee, fry, fry a hen. This struck Warren as tremendously funny, and he went about the house giving Tom's version of the piece as often as he gave the correct one. The morning of the day, it looks like it's going to storm, and the kids go off to school. The schoolroom was decorated with evergreen branches and a loop of faded bunting, and the children were conspicuously starched and clean. Miss Parker herself had on a black silk apron instead of the usual one of speckled calico. Caddy's heart beat a little faster, but not so much for herself as for Warren, whose face wore a look of dark foreboding. Could one possibly forget a piece so short as his? Wondered Caddy uncomfortably. Then she heard Miss Parker calling her name, and she got up without any hesitation, mounted the platform, and made the neat curtsy Mother had taught her. A traveler on a dusty road strewed acorns on the lea, and one took root. It went off perfectly, gestures, Boston accent, and everything. She dropped another curtsy and returned to her seat, feeling that, perhaps for the first time in her life, she had acquitted herself exactly as an accomplished young lady. Too bad Mother hadn't been there to see. While she was still glowing, Miss Parker announced, "And now Master Warren Woodlawn will be heard in a recitation. Come right here in front, Warren." For a moment, Warren clung desperately to the bench on which he sat. Then with a rush, he mounted the platform and began to recite in a very loud voice, "If at first you don't fricassee, fry, fry a hen." "Oh," said Caddy. "Oh," said everybody else in various degrees of consternation and amusement. The titters spread into a roar of laughter. "Warren Woodlawn," said Miss Parker grimly, "you will please stop and see me after school." So poor Warren had a terrible time giving his piece, and Tom at the end, she tries to make him say it right, and he can't say it right. He keeps all that would come out, try as he might, was fry, fry a hen. "Oh, say, ma'am," said Tom, coming quickly forward with his nicest smile, "I guess it's my fault, 'cause I taught him. You see, it's the first purse he ever spoke, and I guess he's pretty scared. I hope you'll forgive him and lay the blame on me." So the teacher does, but our kids have always said, "If at first you don't fricassee, fry, fry a hen, too," and have gotten some fun out of that. Another book that you may know is The Moffats, and Janie in that story was the one I used for the opener, where she is supposed to dance, and her friend is talking about getting sick. You know, that's stage fright. But that particular chapter is really about her brother Joe, who doesn't think he's going to have to dance in the program. He's only supposed to turn pages and seat the people that come to the recital. But he gets a nasty shock because the dancing teacher says that Chester Pudge, who was supposed to do the sailor's hornpipe, has not turned up, and so therefore Joseph Moffat will do the dance. "Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that I give you Joseph Moffat in the sailor's hornpipe." Joe gulped in his breath and said to himself, "Wait till I get that Chet Pudge." He stumbled over his heavy boot strings and wished his corduroy trousers did not squeak so as he marched to the middle of the hall. "Mercy on us," he heard Miss Chichester gasp as he stalked past her. "I didn't know he had those heavy boots on. I thought, of course, he'd be wearing his dancing shoes." One pair of shoes was as good as another to Joe when it came to sailors' hornpipes, but he was furious with himself to think the shoes he had on might have served as a good excuse for not doing the dance. Miss Nippon started the lively tune, and Joe started to shuffle his feet. He could see it was going to be far worse than he had expected, even. Stamp, 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 slap, slap. That's all he could remember of it, a great deal of stamping and slapping. His boots made a terrific clatter, and his trousers kept up that whistling and squeaking. He had never felt more foolish and miserable in his whole life. He could hardly hear the music. Miss Chichester kept time by clapping her hands very hard and nodding her head back and forth so that the hairpins flew. Stamp, stamp, slap, slap. He kicked his legs and slapped his thighs. What next, he wondered. Was this going to go on forever? But what was this? Sugar, Mrs. Milligan's dog Sugar, who had slept peacefully in her lap through such dances as A Daisy Do, To a Wild Rose, and Nellie Take a Kiss, suddenly sat bolt upright. Every nerve in his taut little body was alive and vibrant. He uttered a joyful yelp and bounded from Mrs. Mulligan's lap to the center of the floor where Joe was performing. He stood up on his hind legs, bowed, stamped, shuffled, and turned this way and that. Anyone could see that he was dancing as perfect a sailor's hornpipe as a small furry dog possibly could. Well, that scene brought down the house, and the dance of the hornpipe with the little dog and Joe was so popular that they had to do it all over again. And this time, when Joe was dancing with the little dog, he didn't mind it. and it turned out that the dog had once belonged to a sailor who had taught him to dance the hornpipe while he himself danced and played the harmonica. And when the little dog heard the noise of the sailor's hornpipe, that was his cue to come out and start dancing too. I wouldn't be surprised if that's a true story, because both Caddy Woodlawn and the Moffats are based on true stories of true people, and those may very well be true. To go back to the stage fright, here's one other section I'd like to read you, and this is out of my own book called Turn Not Pale, Beloved Snail. When I was little, I took violin lessons. Every spring there'd be a recital. I can remember standing in the hallway, my fiddle under my arm, trying to rub the cold sweat off the palms of my hands onto my satin dress. I both wanted to play and dreaded it. Then came the terrible, wonderful moment when it was my turn, and legs not my own marched me out in front of the piano, and there in the dimness of the audience sat the family, with my little brother smirking and making faces. I tucked my fiddle under my chin. The piano struck the opening chords. I started out on the first tremulous tones with wavering bow, and in my stomach, strong waves of almost nausea. Then gradually came the confidence. It's going to be all right. I'm going to make it. My bow has quit bouncing. And the forgetting of the lights and audience, and finally the exhilaration of coming through and knowing I'd done a passable job, maybe even a good one in spite of a few mistakes, and the blessed relief of having it all over. I understand stage fright from the inside. I can believe it when Pablo Casals, in his 90s and the world's greatest cellist, said that he still had stage fright when he performed. Telling that story of a recital when I was a kid, my sister didn't fare as well with my little brother, just smirking and making faces, because at one of her recitals, he pulled a trick on her. We had a song that we sang at home that had to do with, a lady sailed away on a bright and summer day on the back of a crocodile. You can see, said she, he's as tame as he can be, so I'll ride him down the Nile. The croc winked his eye as she waved them all goodbye, wearing a happy smile. At the end of the ride, the lady was inside, and the smile on the crocodile. Boom, boom. Those two booms, you see, are the last two beats. And instead of saying boom, boom, you make your hands go like a crocodile's mouth, opening and shutting. And my little brother sat there in the front row when my sister was trying to play the violin in the recital and made his hands go like the crocodile. And she saw him do it and got so upset, you know, started to laugh, that it ruined her piece. Maybe you've had your piece ruined, too. Well, did you ever have to perform and then get sick or feel like you were going to get sick? Did you ever perform and really get sick so that you couldn't go on? One of your teachers did, but with a funny twist. Leona Hacker down at Verdon was everything in the Christmas play. She knew everybody's lines. She had a big part. She knew, the pulling of the curtains, all the props and so forth. She was the strongest person in the Christmas play, and just before the Christmas play, she got the chicken pox. She was taking a bath to go back to school and be in the play, and there she was covered with chicken pox. Her mother telephoned and said that Leona could not be in the Christmas play, and the teacher gulped hard and said, "Send her anyway." So with the chicken pox, Leona came, because there wouldn't have been any Christmas play without her. And everybody else paid the price later, as they too all got the chicken pox and had to stay home. A disaster that didn't involve the whole class was when my mother, as a child, had to do a toe dance. And at the very end, she came up on her toes and somehow turned her ankle and went down in a heap. But she managed to throw her arms up gracefully and smile through the pain, and everybody applauded and thought that the ending was supposed to be that way. She told me that another time she was in the limelight, she came out on the basketball court at the women's college that she went to, and there was a big bunch of people there to watch the teams play basketball. And she was holding the ball, and she just threw it in the direction of the basket all the way across the hall. She didn't have any expectation that she was going to make the basket, and she didn't even really particularly aim, but lo and behold, it went right down there through the basket, and everybody gasped that she could make a basket from such a distance. And so after that, she was the one that everybody watched play basketball. That was a joyful performance. I'd say my most unexpected and most joyful performance of being in the limelight was when I was in high school and was playing in the music clinic at the University of Wisconsin. And we were playing a piece called Iphigenia in Aulis. And Dr. Prager, who was conducting the orchestra, came to rehearsal that day, and he stopped with his baton in the air, and he said in his slow way, "Can anyone tell us the story of Iphigenia in Aulis?" And my heart leapt up because I was taking Latin in high school, and I had just written a play that spring that dealt with Iphigenia and how her father had wanted to sacrifice her on the shores of Aulis, actually did, in order to get a favorable wind for all the ships going to Troy. And so I stood up behind my cello and I told the whole story of Iphigenia in great detail. And then I sat down just dizzy with pride because I was the only one that had known the story and I'd told it so well. My daughter Megan told me her most joyful performance was in a Tom Sawyer play that she was in. This was a play of local kids. They got it up by themselves and they worked it all out. And one thing that was fun was that the audience moved their chairs around, that it was held in a backyard, and we moved actually down into the dirt basement for Injun Joe's cave and down the hill through the weeds to the river for the river scenes and sat at the back of the house for Aunt Polly's house and over by the fence for the whitewash scene. So that Megan, though, had a bit part. She had Sid. The bigger kids were Tom and Injun Joe and Huck and so forth, Becky, and Megan had to be Sid. So at the very end, when Tom and Huck, you know, get all the money, why, Megan thought to herself, well, it would be a Sid-like thing to come in and hog that money. And so Megan trotted onto whatever particular stage there was at that point and gathered up all the money and carried it off. And she thought this was a good touch, and the rest were rather indignant. And the whole audience, of course, all the parents that were there, laughed and got a big kick out of it. So for today, write about when you were in the limelight, a Christmas play or some other. Did somebody ever get the part that you wanted, for instance, that you knew you'd be good at so that you didn't get to be it? Were you happy being in the limelight? Was it difficult or excruciating? Was it funny? My daughter Jillian once was in a trio. They were singing Kumbaya in sixth grade, and the three of them got laughing so hard that they completely cracked up and galumphed off the stage and never did finish the song. It doesn't need to be a performance of a particular rehearsed sort. It can be like my Iphigenia in Aulis, or it can be the time when all the eyes are turned on you, when you get called on in school, for instance, and don't know the answer. The main thing is, how did it feel to be in the limelight? How did it feel when all the eyes were on you?
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.